You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm right.
I'm sorry, but I cannot believe the call. You've got Marshawn Lynch in the backfield. I can't believe the call.
Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538, and this is 538's podcast about the week in sports narratives. To my left, Neil Payne, sports writer, 538. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Chad.
And across the table from me, Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist and special guest on Slate's Hang Up and Listen sports podcast this week. Kate, the second sports podcast you've done this week. How's it feel to be right back in the podcast studio?
That's like my new gig now, is sports podcasting.
That's
all
not
the
that
time.
Gig, right?
It's awesome.
If you like the show, you should definitely check out Hang Up and Listen. So on today's show, we're going to recap a pretty thrilling weekend of March Madness action, especially in the men's tournament. And also, we're going to talk about baseball, finally. Baseball is back. First time Hot Takedowns talking about baseball. And then we're also, last week we fixed the women's tournament.
This week,
yeah, it's solved.
It's solved.
I mean, that was a thrilling Connecticut match on a Monday night. And so last week we fixed the women's tournament. This week we're going to fix the extra point in football. We're going to have nothing left to fix pretty soon, guys.
Sports will be perfect.
Except the NCAA and FIFA. Those might take a little longer. And before we really get the show started, I wanted to thank everybody who's been listening and sending feedback to the show. It's been great. Your arms have been even more open than we expected. And a special thanks to those of you who have rated us on the iTunes store. What we've noticed is that it really does help when you rate and leave a review. And so it'd be great for those of you who have it on your to-do list, just like those Geico commercials that I feel like I've seen all March Madness long about, you know, why you haven't spent 15 minutes to call Geico. Why haven't you spent the 15 seconds rate Hot Takedown on
Should we
iTunes?
Be doing that too?
Yeah, guys. I mean,
okay, I got to get on.
I would assume you'd leave five stars.
Who says that I haven't already?
To get right into the show, the men's tournament, it was a pretty scintillating Elite Eight. We had Kentucky beat Notre Dame in what had to have been the game of the tournament so far. And the undefeated season is alive. Kentucky's at 53%, according to the 538 model, to win and therefore to also go undefeated. Wisconsin behind Frank Kaminsky and Sam Decker having career performances left and right. Also in the Final Four will face Kentucky. They're 19% to win. The Tom Izzos, otherwise known as Michigan State.
The Fighting Tom Izzos.
The Fighting Tom Izzos. I like that. Beat Louisville in a gritty game to make it to the Final Four for a seventh time in Tom Izzos' career. They have a 7% chance to win. And Duke is in the Final Four yet again with a 22% chance to win. And so let's dwell on Kentucky a bit. Here's Mike Wilbon on Pardon the Interruption, talking about the scare that Notre Dame gave Kentucky and what comes next.
That game played out close to the way I thought. And I think the other games are going to be close too, Tony, whoever Kentucky plays. They got Wisconsin, whether they play Michigan State or Duke, if they advance. If I expect that game to no definitive favorite. No, I don't see it that way.
Yeah. If they advance. So real quick, and let's get in. 69% to beat Wisconsin. And so that if is Mike Wilbon dwelling in that 31% and 53% to win it all. Guys, will they advance? What are we thinking?
They might. we actually put a percentage on it that you just mentioned, and that's pretty much all we can say at this point. I think with this Kentucky team, because they're undefeated, we gravitate toward the extremes of someone has found the secret formula for beating them when there's a close game, or when they double up on West Virginia, they'll never lose another game ever. But the truth is in between.
And what was that secret formula to Notre Dame almost taking down Kentucky? Do we have any sense of whether it was reproducible in any way?
Well, Notre Dame was the second most efficient offensive team per 100 possessions. And I think you saw why when watching the game, the way they moved the ball, spread the ball, got good shots, took it to the rim. And the team that is number one in points per 100 possessions is Wisconsin. So I think we're going to see a similar test for Kentucky in this game. I think we're going to see a very similar exciting game, which is kind of the antithesis to what everybody has been saying about college basketball, that it's boring and they can't score. And even though that game was in the 60s, it felt like, I don't know if that even matters. It felt like more points. Does that matter?
No, but it also felt tense, right? And Neil, aren't there some people who do like excitement scores based on the number of lead changes and how win probability swings high and low?
Right. Yeah, that's called leverage index. And our friend Ken Pomeroy, who we seem to be talking about every week because he has such a fantastic college basketball stats site, he has win probability graphs for every college game. And they even track leverage. He has a nice little color code wherein red means medium, orange means moderate, yellow means high. And I say these to illustrate that Kentucky on the graph, they never dropped below 50% chance to win until about 7 minutes left in the game itself. So Kentucky, and of course this takes into account their pregame probability of winning, which was around like 80% or perhaps higher. But at the same time, the leverage graph throughout the second half was almost never lower than high, any color other than yellow, which means high leverage. So it was an exciting second half, particularly of play, even though Kentucky had probably in excess of a 75% chance to win up until 15 minutes left, and then they never dropped below 50 until maybe 6 or 7 minutes left.
Did it feel like that watching the game, Kate? Like you were watching some, like, like the win probably never, you never thought Notre Dame actually could win until it was, they were up 6 with however many minutes left.
And I love checking out those graphs in retrospect because it kind of, it's almost like a heart rate. It mirrors your heart rate as a fan when you're watching and your sensibility about the game. You know, in the first half, you're kind of like, Notre Dame is playing well, but you still had this feeling that Kentucky eventually was going to wear that down and maybe pull away. And then right at, it was 10:35 p.m., which I'm thinking is maybe with like 6 minutes, 40 seconds left in the game, Notre Dame had a 66.5% chance to win, which kind of as a fan, I remember thinking, I actually think Notre Dame is more the favorite at this very moment than Kentucky, and the things they had to do down the stretch, free throw shooting at a perfect clip, all the consecutive possessions, scoring, made it clear that they needed an almost perfect final 4 minutes of the game to make that happen. And now, I love this when you log into those win probabilities, now Notre Dame's is 0% to win that game. I love that that's like, that's like the main feature.
I mean, to your earlier point, when I was watching the UConn women's game last night, even though they were tied at halftime, right? Or no, they were trailing at halftime. Yeah. You never actually thought Dayton was going to win that game because we do have a sort of mental win probability in our head based on our priors, as Nate Silver would put it, about what we think is going to happen.
Yeah, I think we all can intuit how much of a lead is safe and even adjust that for how good the team is in the case of Kentucky. I crunched a few numbers on just what it would take to put them in, like, make things 50-50.
Do you make things 50-50 between the two teams or in the game?
In the example of the game on Saturday in which they were 11-point favorites, you would have to be up 6 points on them with 10 minutes left to be a 50% probability of winning. You'd have to be up 4 points on them with 5 minutes to play to have a 50% chance of winning. And so it kind of intuitively we have a sense for that also of you got to be up big on these guys to put them in a hole.
Right, what I'm hearing you say is that you're never actually that likely to take down Kentucky until there's like 2 minutes left and you're up 8 or 10 or something.
They have to be dead and in the ground, I think.
And you mentioned UConn. I think that I would have had to see UConn down 18 or plus at the half to actually think that that Dayton might win. That's incredible because you'd think UConn played what might have been their worst half of basketball maybe of the season, and you're assuming they're going to perform at a higher percentage in the second half. And so when they were tied, I was like, there's no way Dayton wins this game because they would need to be up so much to weather the 20-point. And then similarly, when Tennessee was playing Gonzaga on the women's side, Gonzaga was up 17 with 6 minutes to go, but Tennessee with like a higher talent level, you would say, and like a bunch of seniors who had motivation to win by being Pat Summitt's last group of recruits. That was kind of where the threshold was for me. I was like, if Gonzaga bumps it up to 19, I think they're going to win this game. But the second it went to 15, I was like, it's on.
Right, absolutely. And so one other thing about the Kentucky game, in the game, we came across this great Ken Pomeroy. Right?
He's
sponsoring this podcast?
This month,
what's happening?
He's almost like a fourth member of this podcast.
Yeah, the Holy Ghost. So Ken Pomeroy wrote a piece for Slate, actually, that was about whether or not Kentucky should have fouled at the end of the game on that last possession. When was it, Andrew Harrison or Aaron Harrison?
Yep.
Okay, so when one of the Harrisons was driving down the court, And had the ball in his hands, Notre Dame let Kentucky bleed time off the clock. And Pomeroy's point was that they should have fouled to stop the clock because you have to assume if you're Notre Dame that Kentucky's better than you and is likely to win in overtime or down the stretch. And so you want to stop the clock and control your own destiny, essentially, down for the last 30 seconds of the game. Did you guys buy into that very statsy argument?
I think some of it comes down to some of the same statistical backflips that we all did in the wake of the Pete Carroll decision and how we talked ourselves into saying, in the Super Bowl, into saying that the pass was the better option and that it should have worked and that this is one of the few cases in which it didn't work and that he made the right call. But at the same time, I mean, Kate, you played, and was this something that would have crossed a coach's mind to do, or would is that inherent to a coach to feel like we are going to play straight up defense with the shot clock turned off, 35 seconds left, and take our chances after that? Like, you almost have to buy in and believe in your team enough to not kind of make that foul. That's kind of a more cynical option in which you're acknowledging, hey, we're probably not as good as these guys and we need to strike while they aren't hot.
Yeah, I think there's two things. One, I always felt as a player, and in the feedback I got from coaches, they felt as well, that it's really hard to operate down the stretch in a different manner than you've practiced and played for hours and hundreds and thousands of hours, which is when there's a tie score, you play straight up defense. And there's always, I guess, an energy you're working towards as a basketball player where you have processed all these statistics and scenarios, and that is one you've never practiced before. And as I was reading through KenPom's argument, it took me a really long time to even understand what he was saying about why you would want to foul when it's a tie game. And I do understand numbers wise, but I think the one thing that is tough to account for is having never practiced that scenario ever. Unless you're a coach who has read KenPom and all of a sudden you want to spend 20 minutes at the end of practices repeated times in the preseason throughout the year to say, here's what we might execute down the stretch, which I find unlikely. Actually, I was thinking, if Notre Dame had done this and it had worked, what kind of conversation it would have launched and what kind of thinking college coaches might do going forward.
Or if it hadn't worked, thinking about the backlash, of course, they didn't win anyway, but they didn't win in a very conventional way.
And Kate, what you were saying, that's the tension with all this statistical stuff, is the tension between the sort of cool empirical reality and the reality of people's psychologies, athlete psychologies, as they're maybe spooked because they have to run a different kind of strategy than they've ever practiced to run. And maybe then that argues that statistics enlightened coaches need to be practicing these strategies on the front end as opposed to reacting mid-game or at the end of the game into them.
Yeah, it's very similar to how I feel about like the 2-for-1 argument at the pro level versus the college level, and certainly at the high school level. It's like you're completely speeding up these players' styles of game if you want them to shoot within 7 seconds to get, you know, another possession on the back end. Even though the data might say that it's a good move, if you're asking athletes to do things that over 20 years they've never done, I don't know how you're going to get the kind of output that the numbers say you are.
The other thing we should mention, too, is that the KenPom percentages, that win probabilities that we're talking about here, they're slight when you think of them in aggregate. So according to KenPom's sort of estimations, Notre Dame had a 20% chance to win when Kentucky had the ball, tie game, 36 seconds, whatever it was, left on the clock on that final drive, on that final Kentucky drive. If they had fouled, as we're sort of tossing around the idea of them doing, they would go up to a 23% probability.
Right.
Those are 3 percentage points. So we're talking about a marginal chance of winning. And the question is Mike Bray going to get up at the press conference afterward if he had fouled and say, well, I fouled because I thought it was a 3 percentage point probability spike for my team, and I'm trying to do everything that I can to put my team in position to win. We hear that last part, but we don't usually hear the empirical backing behind it.
Mm-hmm. And that's just short of, like we mentioned, Pete Carroll and his sort of rambling justification of the play call in the Super Bowl. And another thing is that this, it's sort of similar to when a team is down 1 and they score a touchdown in the closing seconds of an NFL game, and the question becomes, do you go for 2 and the win, or do you take the safe option of tying the game and then take your chances in overtime? And statistically, like you had mentioned, Chad, if you, the longer you let the game go on, the more of a chance that a team, if you're facing Kentucky, you're very overmatched compared to them, they can exert their talent advantage. So just from a pure maximizing your chances of winning standpoint, this is where the KenPom thinking comes into play, is that, well, we want to take advantage of our opportunity now because we're probably never going to get a better chance to beat a team like Kentucky than we will right now. But like you said, it involves a lot more than just this calculation of, you know, have we practiced this? Like everything going into that. And also having to stand up there and justify. There's been research about the behavior of coaches, especially in the NFL. We go back because there's a lot of research on their decision making. They're the most dissected of all the coaches, probably. They don't play necessarily to win, despite what some coaches have said, that they actually play to extend the amount of time that they are alive and conceivably have a chance to win the longest. And so that is sort of what this is all about also, is do I give myself a longer opportunity, even if my overall win probability is lower? Have I extended the chance that I'm alive longer versus kind of cutting it off, making that quick decision, and either I win or lose in that exact moment?
Right, so I guess the idea would be, like, if you're on the 3-yard line and you're down 10, you probably should go for the touchdown, but you kick a field goal so that you stay alive, and then but then you got to march all the way down the field again.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Just trying to understand it from a non-data standpoint.
So the Final Four we can't talk about without talking about the four coaches in the Final Four, Calipari included, but chief among them, Tom Izzo. And we talked about Tom Izzo last week, and he only proved why we talked about him last week by winning 2 more games. And Neil, you did some compilations of wins above expectation for coaches within the NCAA tournament. Tell me what you learned, Neil.
Well, I learned that Tom Izzo is incredible. If you look at how many games his teams were supposed to win based on where he was seeded, and making some allowances for how good he was, typically Michigan State is a little bit underseeded. For instance, this year they're a 7 seed. Their power rating probably suggested they should have been like a 6 or 5. But even after making accounts for that, you still find that Izzo has won about really over 16 more games than he, quote unquote, should have. Like if you dropped an average.
And that's
coach,
after this weekend, because we talked about this last week a little bit. Right.
Yeah, he's only added to the gap between him and the other coaches. But another thing that I found interesting was that if you look at those wins above expectation, Calipari is 3rd since the tournament expanded in 1985 to 64 teams. Rick Pitino, who Tom Izzo beat, is 2nd. Coach K is 10th. And then the other Final Four coach, Bo Ryan of Wisconsin, is all the way down at 31st. So he's added 2.7 wins, or his teams have exceeded by that much. Izzo have exceeded by 16 wins. But once you get to the Final Four, you've all exceeded your expected wins. So you can kind of throw that out the window, perhaps.
Except Calipari this year.
What I found really interesting about that chart was actually the coaches with the worst numbers.
Right.
Because the storyline around those coaches, Lute Olson, Rick mm-hmm. Barnes, Mike Montgomery, Bob Knight, is that they're some of the greatest coaches in college basketball history. And so I know this is strictly NCAA tournament, but what can you, I guess, does... What does that say, I guess, about are they not as good coaches as the storylines have told us they are?
Well, I think it depends on what your definition of a good coach is, though, because in order to have a high number of expected tournament wins, you have to be consistently seeded really well. So you have coached numerous 20-win, you know, regular season teams, mm-hmm. if not more. And also, you have to be a good coach in order to have the job security to be a Rick Barnes, who did get fired, but only after a string of multiple disappointing tournament
runs.
Even
with Kevin Durant that 1 year.
Right, yeah. Exactly. I mean, that's maybe the prime example of him taking a team.
Enjoy Tennessee. Enjoy Rick Barnes, Barnes experience.
Him being, perhaps he's a great recruiter, perhaps he's a great regular season coach that it just doesn't translate, or maybe he's even just unlucky. It's certainly possible that you could just lose a few games, and you get docked not just for the game that you lose, but you get docked if you're a one seed or a two seed for the future games that you should have won and you're just not even present for under this system. So it also speaks to almost in a weird way, to be at the top of the list, you have to be a good coach. And to be at the bottom of the list, you also have to be a good coach in kind of a different way, because you have to have convinced people to not fire you despite numerous disappointing tournament runs.
And had to have good regular seasons.
Yes.
Okay.
And so one of the other things that list popped out to me was that something we talked about either last week or the week before, about whether how much systems matter in college basketball, because these guys do have systems. That's one of the reasons that they succeeded the way they have. And Kate, when you were playing, did you feel as an athlete feel like the system really did affect the way that your coach instilled at Colorado, really did affect the way that you played? Like, or were you a different player than if you had gone to Tennessee or to Delaware or wherever else?
Yeah, it was remarkable. Like, let's just look at the Big 12, the former composition of the Big 12 before everything split because of football. Our system at Colorado was, we ran the triangle. We were very, like, disciplined, and we recruited a certain kind of player who was maybe not as athletic as certain other programs, but was, like, not going to mess up kind of player. And you looked around the Big 12 then, and there were other programs where I could, at the time and still now, rattle off exactly what those systems were about. And I think to this day, if you asked a college, even a men's college basketball player, name me these top 10 programs, give me like their five characteristics, they would all be able to do that, because that existed then. If you asked me about Duke, Tennessee, I could tell you specifically what those programs were about and specifically what kind of player you were and why you went somewhere. That was key.
And that's the nature of college sports in general, is the coaches take on more importance to each program and become the identity in the face of it. Because by definition, the players are not going to be there, especially in college basketball. Now, only 1 year in the case of the best players, the ones that you would think would become the faces of the program. But even back in the day, I mean, Tim Duncan was at Wake Forest, and 4 years later, he wasn't. Like, you have to be prepared to move on, and the coach is the one constant that sort of takes you through this long lineage of players moving in and out.
And now a word from our sponsor. All of 538's March Madness coverage is brought to you by Acura. The Acura ILX is quick off the line with a 201 horsepower, 2.4-liter iVTEC engine. With an 8-speed dual-clutch transmission, the 2016 ILX delivers rapid and smooth shifts while instantly reacting to your every move. In the ILX, you can stay connected as you drive with Siri eyes free and respond hands-free to texts or emails and set reminders or even check the weather. Witness the quickness for yourself. Go to Acura.com/ILX or head to your nearest Acura dealership for a test drive. The 2016 Acura ILX. Catch it if you can. And so let's go to the politics side of the NCAA, of the Final Four for a second. Last week, Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana, signed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was a bill somewhat similar to those in other states that aimed to protect citizens when they exercised their religion. This Indiana law was different, though, because it explicitly allowed those being sued to raise a religious freedom defense when they were brought to court, even in discrimination cases. And so gay rights advocates were deeply troubled by it, very worried. They said that it opened the possibility for the kind of thing that we saw during the civil rights era, where a state defends itself, that the people defend themselves shrouded in a state's law as their defense. And so, for example, a florist would be allowed not to to say that they weren't going to serve a gay couple's wedding because on the grounds that their religion said that they didn't agree with homosexuality and with gay marriage. And so one of the first companies or organizations to say that they were disturbed by this was the NCAA. And it brought up the question in our minds about whether sort of what role sports have to play in political change in the country. And Kate, I know you did some reporting on this for ESPN.
I initially, when I heard about the bill, wanted to throw down with like a hot take on it. And even though the Final Four was only a week away, I was like, get it out of there and move the 2016 Women's Final Four out of Indy, not to mention the NFL Combine and the Big Ten Championship. I mean, Indy is just, because of its location, a hotbed for hosting big-time events. But I was surprised to learn, right, that Indiana just became the 20th state to have some version of this bill. and trying to.
So not this bill, though. It was a version of a bill similar to the kind of thing that's on that the federal government sort of instituted.
Right. Indiana, they passed a version of the religious freedom bill,
right,
that 19 other states have. And certainly the language in the Indiana one is slightly more worrisome if you, are a gay activist. But what I ended up finding, right, was that this year, say, the Women's Final Four is in Tampa, which also, as a statewide, has a religious freedom bill and also does not have, like, statewide sweeping extensive protections, anti-gay discrimination protections. So very similar to Indiana, but nobody is calling for the Women's Final Four to move out of Tampa.
And so what's the NCAA's role here? I mean, is it to take a stand on when these issues bubble up into the zeitgeist, into the national zeitgeist, which the Indiana one did more than whatever's happening in Florida? And I haven't looked at the details of the bill, so I don't know if it's as onerous or potentially onerous against gay rights as the Indiana one seems to be. But what's an amateur athletics organization to do, Neil?
If I knew that, I would be the president of the NCAA. But I do think it's kind of interesting how these big sports entities will, like you said, there's little fanfare when they're playing it, when it's not almost like politically convenient to make a statement and make a show of support for a certain cause, when also at the same time the NCAA is notorious for not paying its players, and they're for it to kind of raise an ethical issue on one side and then ignore its own ethical issues could be construed as hypocritical. And we also see, like, the NFL has had a very mixed record on a lot of issues, whether it be domestic abuse or even just the way that players have been treated. The head injury crisis was only really brought to bear when the NFL could no longer go on further without and they had to address it. So, yeah, and this is not even getting into the fact that leagues have sort of exploited, tax loopholes and tried to set themselves up as nonprofits and used public funding for stadiums. So the role of sports and ethics in society is a very it's a gray area, and I don't know if anyone really knows what the prescribed role of an organization like the NCAA is in this.
I wondered too if the NCAA had a special role because it's associated with colleges, which we think of as a place where young people come into their own and into their own life, and for many people, coming out as gay in college is part of their college experience. And I wondered, and we have an openly gay athlete in the men's side of the NCAA, and many, I believe, in the women's side. Is that right?
Well, there's not as much, like, media coverage, so I'm sure there are many, but we wouldn't, we wouldn't put it in a story, so I'm not sure, But yes, I'm sure there are some. We have Derek Corden, right, on the men's side, and then on the women's side, certainly there are. I think, though, the NCAA does have a history of making a political statement and standing up for human rights in its history. I mean, the NCAA will not allow a predetermined event to exist in, like, a state like South Carolina that flies a Confederate flag. The NCAA has, at many previous times, leveraged its economic power because of its affiliation with schools and its commitment to diversity and inclusion. And then as much as anybody, I certainly knock the NCAA for certain flaws. But the NCAA does have a great diversity and inclusion department and has done great work in trying to put out education about these issues and value diversity and inclusion. So I do think it has a role to play here. And I do think the reason we're seeing this right now is because of awareness and because of the timing. I mean, Indiana passing this 1 week before one of the biggest events on the sports calendar means something, as opposed to it happening at some point where we're months away from anything that the sports world may pay attention to.
So let's leave that there and transition on to baseball, guys. Smell that sweet grass, those Frankfurters roasting boiling in the concession guy's bucket that he's carrying around his neck. It's the first time we talked about baseball, so I think we owe it to our listeners to confess our attachment or total lack of attachment at baseball. Neil, you've got a Phillies hat on.
I love baseball.
What do you love about baseball, Neil?
Practically everything about it. It's just been since I was a child. I have really just fallen in love with the game. And sabermetrics as another area that, I probably wouldn't have this job right now if it weren't for Moneyball and even people like our boss, Nate Silver, writing about baseball and really getting the statistical side of things. So I think it's really at the core of what we do here at 538 for more reasons than just Nate's background in baseball.
Do you think you love baseball more because, as a numbers person, there are certain more categories that are easier to define in baseball than any other sport?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. It's by far the most quantifiable of all the sports.
And do you think that contributes to your love for it?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it certainly
I'm sensing
detract.
Kate by so, those questions that you may not love it like Neil loves it.
You know, I grew up and I love the New York Mets. Watched
who couldn't?
Who
I mean,
could
everyone
not
loves
them.
They're so lovable.
They are so lovable. And growing up, I would watch almost every single game. And my dad, to this day, watches every single game. So maybe he can come on the podcast and talk about baseball. No, but I have not watched much baseball since Carlos Beltran went down swinging.
I had that tattooed on my heart, so I never forget the pain.
The pain of it.
Yeah.
But, of course, I read about baseball, and I try and understand baseball. And I actually just had a conversation yesterday with some of my friends when I mentioned that it sounded like we were going to talk about baseball on this podcast. What do I do? There's, a lot of fear happening. And they were like, people watch baseball? Is that still a thing?
The ratings are not so great, actually.
But I do find there are certain fascinating storylines, and I love how quantifiable it is. And so there are certain moments where I get involved, but as just a general fan who's going to, every year my dad's like, let's go to the ballpark. And I'm like, let's not.
So one of the fascinating storylines.
So let's talk baseball.
Yeah, so let's talk baseball. By the end of this season, Kate, we are going to totally transform you into
the
same
nutrition. I'm going to be in a fantasy
league. Yeah. So one of the biggest stories a few days out from the season is this guy, Chris Bryant. He of the insane spring training. This guy has an OPS, which is on-base percentage, plus slugging. I wonder how many times they're going to define various acronyms that
many
we say in sabermetric.
Many times.
You're lucky I skipped the question about what your favorite sabermetric acronym was. Mine's XFIP, but we can leave that for another day. Yeah. So Chris Bryant had an OPS of 1.65. If it's above one, you're not usually saying 1 point when you're talking about OPS. In spring training, 9 home runs, 15 RBIs in 44 plate appearances. That's crazy good. Yet, he will not be on the opening day roster for the Chicago Cubs. The Cubs are keeping him in the minors so they can delay his free agency by one extra year because of very interesting and weird ins and outs of the collective bargaining agreement in baseball. So that if he played before the Cubs' 10th game this year, then this year would count as a year of service time. And so the Cubs would lose a year of his service because this would count as a year of service. So he'd be a free agent a year sooner. Keith Olbermann thinks that this will not pay off. Hot take number two.
Also, you're talking about protecting him for the 2021 season, by which point he could have arthritis in both knees or be a professional plate spinner for all we know.
So is Olbermann right about that? Is Chris Bryant likely to have arthritis in both knees or one knee, let alone both knees, by the time he's 29?
Or he could be a plate spinner, don't forget.
Right, yeah, sorry, yeah. He might drop out of baseball totally.
Probably not, if you look at the aging curve of guys like this. And just from a practical standpoint, it sadly makes sense for teams to do things like this because they really are only giving up a handful of games, whether it be early, almost always early in the season, when they're not at their peak, to get a whole year of performance from a guy when he is in his peak. So it's a no-brainer, and it's just a consequence of, like you said, some of the arcane collectively bargain loopholes that you have to go through in baseball that, you know, every sport has these weird things in their corner cases that don't usually come up. And when they do come up, everyone gets outraged because of the absurdity. But you have to draw the line somewhere. And there have been proposals that, well, you should change the requirement for a year of service, and you should make them, you know, make the decision between holding a guy down in the minors until June, and then maybe the Cubs would think twice about leaving Bryant down, especially since they have been, you know, talked about as one of the dark horse teams. When has that ever happened for a Cubs team going into the season? That they probably can't afford to leave him down for a half a season, but they probably can for a couple weeks.
So we're going to get there in a second. So the way that FanGraphs, which is a sort of the online mecca of baseball nerds, Kate, have you frequented FanGraphs before?
No.
It's in hot green background, and it's a very visceral experience to go to FanGraphs. So FanGraphs put it nicely. They said that losing 2 weeks of 23-year-old Bryant is better than losing 6 months of 29-year-old Bryant. And that gets to Neil's point about the age curve, which is that players are better when they're 29 than when they're 23.
When they're not plate spinners,
right.
When they're older.
Right, okay. Good point. Yeah,
let's keep that in mind.
Although, I don't know, plate spinners might have some hand-eye coordination or something. And so Olbermann has, hot as ever, had a second hot take, which was about that first week that they're missing and why it may matter. First week that the Cubs are missing of Bryant and why it may matter so much. So let's play one more clip from Olbermann.
I know about this stat that even if Chris Bryant were to be the greatest rookie third baseman ever, he'd be worth about 0.5 in wins above replacement if he missed the first nine games of the season. But that 0.5, that could be the RBI that wins the game by which the Cubs would have been competitive.
Yeah, I love Keith Olbermann. He's incredible. And so it could be the RBI that wins the game.
It could be.
Or it could be the meaningless hit in the top of the third that doesn't do anything for them winning.
What if the Cubs start 0-9?
Sorry?
What if the Cubs start 0-9?
Yeah, right.
People will be fired up.
There's just going to be controversy.
And so one of the things that because baseball is such a structured data sport that Fangraphs again does, and Fangraphs will be the Ken Palm of baseball for this podcast.
I'm getting used to hearing about them.
And so they do things called Steamer and Zips, and these are projections that Neil, you can explain better than me.
Yeah, I mean, they're just projection systems. Our boss Nate Silver made his own called Pacoda, and they just attempt to look at a player's past track record and also perhaps similar players to that player from the past, and try to say what's he going to do this year, you know, most likely, and come up with a projection. So, Fangraphs, I almost called them Ken Palm, houses a number of these, and they all say that Bryant is going to be a good player.
But not the best third baseman of all time, like Olbermann was saying. He's not going to have a 10 win above replacement. According to the Fangraphs projections, it's going to be somewhere in the high 3 or low 4 range.
Which is really good for a rookie.
Really good. But those first 9 days aren't going to decide the Cubs season.
Certainly not.
It's 3 or 4 games over an entire season. Right? You're saying?
What do you mean?
The 3 or 4 number over the entire season.
Yeah, over the entire season. Exactly. So when you divide that by 1/15 or whatever, it's barely anything.
Also, doesn't this happen all the time in the NFL where franchises, if a guy has an incentive to be on the active roster for 16 games, he gets an extra $100,000 and then they sit him? I mean, these loopholes exist in every single league, not to mention what the Cubs are doing exists in like the business world on a day-to-day basis. If you have like a young hotshot, you don't want to promote him too early. You don't want another business to poach him. Like, these things exist in the real world. So baseball needs to get over itself. That's my hot take.
Alternatively, the players' union can negotiate this out of the CBA next time.
Yeah.
Right? It's on everybody that is a feature of the game in the first place.
And it bears mentioning that Chris Bryant is not actually represented by the players' union right now. So it was largely an empty gesture when the Players Association came out and said, "Oh, we'll be keeping an eye on this situation," and saying that it was a little bit unethical what the Cubs had done. At the end of the day, the Cubs are fully within their rights to do this, and the reason why they are is because the Players Association collectively bargained this system of service time. And you can argue that in baseball, the system of 6 years of team control before you're truly a free agent is flawed compared to other sports where you have to put up or shut up with a player and pay them sooner. But that is between the union and the owners, ultimately.
The other thing that this brings up is whether spring training matters. And I said at the top of the segment that Chris Bryant had an insane spring training, but are we to trust spring training as an indicator of performance when the season actually starts?
Well, not a whole lot. I did an article last year, probably around this time, where I looked at, do players that have a particularly hot or cold spring training perform differently than you would expect from their projections, which, like one of these Steamer or Zips projections, which have presumably assume no especially strange spring training happenings. And there was a statistically significant effect in which a player who played really well in the spring outperformed what you would expect from him otherwise, controlling for his projections, but it was a really small effect, and maybe you could argue that it would be more with someone like Bryant because the projection for him is based on minor league stats, and we don't have a long history of major league. In fact, we have no history of major league track record for him, but at the same time, it's probably indicative that he's on the right track, but it ultimately doesn't mean a whole lot. We'll learn more about him in the first month of the season than we do over the last month of spring training, for sure.
Right, and if I read those articles correctly, it made it seem as if for it to become statistically significant, this player had to like be amazing in spring training,
which Bryant has.
Yeah, and this is what I'll do whenever we talk about baseball, is like related to basketball in a couple ways. One, I was surprised to read when Nate Silver had the story about how much preseason college basketball ratings actually affect a team's performance in the end. Certainly, it's not a direct correlation to spring training. And the second thing is that, like, as an athlete, you can kind of tell, at least I could, when you start playing with people in the preseason after, like, they've had a summer to work out, or in baseball's case, a winter to work out. You can see a player, and if they are performing well above where you saw them last year, you can kind of see how the model is going to flatten out a little bit, but they are going to perform better. And that always happened in college. People will come back from off season, and you could tell in those preseason workouts how that model was going to play out. And it was almost kind of like anecdotally.
You guys were talking about that on the Slate podcast a little bit with Abby Wambach in women's soccer, and maybe that she had lost a step since the last World Cup had come around. Yeah. And you could tell that she'd gotten older. I mean, that's a bigger layoff, but like that, especially on the other side of the age curve from Chris Bryant, when players get older, you can sometimes really tell that there's a tick off their fastball or their swing's a little slower in the baseball.
And sometimes I wonder whether when you're a young player going into spring training, you were trying to crush it. And respectively, like to like Abby, she's not really that worried about how she's looking in training. She's kind of at a different model where like, I might look worse in spring training when I'm older because I know what matters. And so I wonder if there's a model for that.
And you don't want to hurt yourself, overexerting in games that don't matter if you're an older player.
Probably. Right. Yeah.
So let's move on to the next segment. There are going to be plenty of baseball talk about. Trust me, I have all sorts of things that I've saved that we were supposed to talk about today that will come up again, I'm sure. And move to football, which is in the offseason, but there basically is never an offseason when it comes to the NFL, given everyone's love of it. And there are various rule changes that are being floated around right now. And one that caught our eye a couple weeks ago was that the Colts were maybe saying that there should be a 9-point play in football where you score a touchdown, there's your 6 points. You do a 2-point conversion, and then if you make it as a reward, you get one extra point, a field goal. I think it was like from the 50-yard line.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was sort of the first hint that we had that people thought the extra point might be broken. And Peter King at Sports Illustrated and reported today or this week that the extra point is not long for the world. That 30, according to him, 30 of 32 teams want to do away with it. And we don't know what's going to come of it.
Who are those two teams who want to keep it?
I like that question.
Okay, next time.
Probably, what do you think?
The Giants? The old school?
Old school, yeah. Or really like tactician masterminds who think there's some like maybe Belichick is in love with the extra point or something because he can
shave a corner. He's subversive in it.
And so nothing's certain yet about how they're going to fix it. According to King, the sort of compromise plan that's been floated is to move the 1-point kick, the point after the touchdown, the extra point, back to the 15-yard line from the 2-yard line, to making it a 32-yard attempt. And that going for two may be moved up a little bit to the 1.5 or 1-yard line. And so here's former coach Herm Edwards on the NFL Network discussing these new rules and sort of what to do about it and whether it'll change a coach's calculus.
Get it implemented as quick as you can. So on the offseason, you can start planning how you're going to go about doing this. All of a sudden, you put on a 1-yard line. A lot of coaches are going to go for 2 points. Now, all of a sudden, that defensive tackle you have, you want him to be the 2-point guy.
So is he right? Would changing this really change coaches' approach?
I mean, it would change their mental computations, especially since you can't have any kind of calculator type device on the sideline. You have to go into the games sort of knowing what the trade-offs are going to be between these things. And in a lot of cases, it's not clear. I think a lot of coaches also, our colleague Ben Morris has done a lot of work on how much better kickers are now than they used to be in the past, even from very long distances that when a lot of the coaches who are coaching now, when they played or when they were learning about the game first, seemed like a much less probable make than they actually are. When you're having to make those gut calls during the middle of a game, I think it probably will make a difference to be prepared with the most up-to-date percentages about the trade-offs between do I go for two or do I kick.
I really hope they don't move the 2-point attempt to the 1-yard line because it will just become like smash mouth, as opposed to now. Most of the time with 2-point attempts, you see like a fade to the corner. You see some sort of play that's a little more entertaining. And when I was reading about this, do you know that 15 teams have not missed an extra point this decade? That has to be one of the only plays in all of sports that is just a shoe-in. I can't think of another in a sport where it's actually not even interesting to watch because of the percentages of it. I mean, it's like the equivalent of following somebody in basketball and having them take a layup. we would have ruled that out a very long time ago.
But moving it back to the 32-yard line, that wouldn't necessarily change
it that
much.
No, it makes it like 93%
right.
Kickers
so,
are kicking at that distance, right?
According to Ben Morris's data, as Neil said earlier, at a piece that he wrote for 538 called Kickers Are Forever, which is sort of like our virtuosic accomplishment of obsession with kickers, from the 30 to 39-yard range for a kick, it was something in the range of 85% as opposed to 99% for the extra point. And so when you actually look at the numbers of where you would have to – if part of the point of this balance – or I guess maybe the question is what's the point of the point after the touchdown? Should it be that should the NFL try and incentivize teams to go for two because that's the exciting play, it's the marketable play, whatever? Or should it be to have it be an even split between the expected points when you kick a field goal and the expected points when you go for it, go for a 2-point conversion? Like what should the league be incentivizing? Do you guys think
that makes sense to me?
Yeah,
having the balance.
Yeah, having the balance.
Well, what's funny is they have that balance now, though, because the extra point is made, like you said, almost 100% of the time. It has an expected value of 1, and when teams are trying to get those 2 yards, whether it be a conversion, a 2-point conversion, or even in the open field on like 4th and 2, they generally get it about half of the time. So, in the most broad possible sense, both plays have an expected value of 1. But I think the fact that 99.6% of extra points are made, the league, like you said, it's a boring way to get that 1 point on average. And so they have this mandate from above to the committee, the competition committee, to find a way to just, however you do it, make the play more exciting and less automatic, even if you have to adjust the trade, even if the trade-off is the same.
And one thing that would make this more exciting is the ability for the defense to score 2 points off of it if they blocked it or if they intercepted it on a 2-point. I mean, that if that doesn't exist, so you end up with defenses who kind of just let these extra points be gimmies, as opposed to if you incentivize the defense that there's also a reward for them. Now, obviously, it's a much harder play to turn that into 2 points, but if that does exist, it makes it a live football play.
And it does happen with some amount of frequency. At least there are very memorable plays in college where you are allowed to return it and get the points. So that goes also under the umbrella of how can we make this perfunctory play after a touchdown more exciting? Mm-hmm.
And a few numbers on what would happen if the NFL moved the 2-point conversion to the 1-yard line as opposed to the 2-yard line. So, Neil, you said they make it almost half the time from the 2. It's 48% from the 2. Weirdly and super interestingly, a down and goal from the 2-yard line, so first and goal, second goal, third goal, whatever, is only made 38% of the time. And we think that might be because and 2, maybe 2.5 yards or 2.99 yards. Doesn't mean it's 2 exactly like it does on a 2-point conversion attempt. But let's just say 48% for a 2-point conversion. And then for the for down and goal from the 1-yard line, so first and goal, second and goal, whatever else, it's punched in 53% of the time. So not a huge spike, actually, only 5 percentage points. Now, on 2-point conversions where it's from the 1-yard line because of a penalty, say, right half the distance to the goal, there were only 29 of them since 2001, but it went in 65% of the time. So it does seem to be something different about the conversion that spikes the probability that goes in.
Yeah, I wonder if it's the plays they run. They've practiced specific 2-point conversion plays at a higher rate than they've practiced like their sets, their sequences from the goal line, because that's a significant difference.
Right. And so to your point, Kate, about these being gimmies and maybe they shouldn't be, why is it that we try and give a team an extra point, like a fair shake, an extra point? Why not move the extra point kick to be a 60-yarder? So it takes real skill. It would totally change the drafting, the way teams draft kickers. And maybe you do it without a line of scrimmage or something. Maybe it's like a place kick. And the 2-point conversion, then to even it out, if we want to pursue balance, would be whatever it would be, you know, from the 10-yard line or something. Like, why is it that we think they have to be so close to the goal just because they got it in the play before that next play?
I don't know. I wish we could, like, rewind time and ask these people why they put it in place like that.
Yeah, I mean, why does anything exist in the rules of football? There's a lot of things that are kind of arbitrary and vestigial elements of, you know, former versions of the game or rugby or what have you. But another thing that's interesting is that it seems like the league, or at least a lot of talking heads, have had a push for there to just be less kicking in general. That, you know, since kicking plays don't totally resemble the other plays of football, that games should be decided on plays that are made among, I hesitate to say, real football players, but that seems to be the sentiment among many people. And, you know, if you sweeten the deal for the two-point conversion and maybe don't keep that balance of expected points equal, but you sort of try to get the coaches to go for two more by pushing the field goal back but then pushing the two-point conversion closer, then you're how much would you have to do that to incentivize coaches away from the safety of that one-point conversion? Because I think that's why they do it. They grab the one guaranteed point instead of the variance, and maybe that even goes to what we said earlier about coaches wanting to extend the how long they're alive in a game instead of just going for the jugular.
And sometimes I wonder if kicking was added because they were like trying to resemble rugby in some way, and that was like the old world sport. And so they were like, well, we have to have some element of kicking in this sport.
I mean, it is called football.
They had to justify that in some way, right, to steal the name. I know next sometime we need to talk about making the width of the goalpost much narrower.
Ooh, like because, arena football.
Because the rate at which kickers kick right now, way better than free throw percentages. It's not even field goal kicks aren't even as exciting as they used to be.
So producer Jody, who long time listeners have heard and seen the Digit section, is IMing from in the booth and saying that the two teams that we were talking about are not public. But Belichick has publicly said he's in favor of changing the point after
and
touchdown.
And cameras on the goal line. He's hot on
right.
that.
Yeah.
He just loves cameras.
So let's bring it close to that and then bring in Allison McCann for our significant digit. Before we do, one quick mea culpa. Last week, we made a mistake about cricket, guys. And this is one of the reasons that we banished Jody to the producer's booth. No, not at all. But we did make a mistake about cricket. We said that the Cricket World Cup uses the T20 format for matches, but it doesn't.
Nope.
It uses the one-day international format, which gives each side 50 overs, not 20. Sorry to all those cricket fans, but thank you for letting us know that there's such a big
listening.
Yeah, and there's such a big cricket audience. It's good to know for future. Okay, so Allison McCann is here finally back after traveling. She'll be a regular fixture on Hot Takedown. And Allison, what kind of significant digit have you brought us today?
Hey guys, I'm super happy to be here. I looked hard for like a bullfighting significant digit from my travels, but there was no such. So, this week I'm bringing 227 as the significant digit, which is the average number of hits to the head for hockey players ages 13 through college over the course of one season. Now, this number can vary widely by age and gender, obviously, but it comes from a new study from Virginia Tech's Department of Biomedical Engineering and Mechanics. They have a study out that ranked hockey helmets based on their ability to reduce the risk of concussions. And this is the same group that introduced a similar rating system for football helmets back in 2011, and now they've turned their attention to hockey. So they kind of looked at the 32 helmets that are on the market right now, and they have this 5-star rating system, 1 star being marginal and 5 stars as the best available helmet. But I think it's funny they also have this like not recommended category, which I'm just.
And didn't most of the hockey helmets get not recommended?
I'm like, so this is like an entirely useless helmet. Like, don't even wear it. So of those 32 helmets that they tested, 9 failed to earn even a single star, and just one helmet made by Warrior Sports earned 3 stars. To me, I was like, these findings seem pretty dismal. Like, you know, one helmet out there is, you know, run of the mill, like pretty good, and the risk of concussion for one of those not recommended helmets was like up to 6 per season. And
on those 227 hits to the head per season.
Right. If you are wearing their not recommended, so 0-star helmet, you could have 6. Based on my, you know, very limited knowledge of a concussion, like you get 1, 2, 3 and you're probably getting towards the like, should I be medically retiring? And anyway, I know there's been a lot of debate in the NFL too about whether there should be like max number of concussions that forces you to medically retire, and obviously, you know, depends on the type of person, and maybe that would even have a negative impact if you would be hiding reporting concussions if there was like 5 concussions and you're done. So I don't know. I was wondering what you guys thought.
What I found interesting about reading up on the hockey helmets, one was that the most expensive helmet was $229, which was almost, what is that, $160 more than the best helmet?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the best helmet was $79. So I can see as a parent, you're like, this Reebok CCM helmet is $230, 3 times as much as the other ones. It's 3 times better. Got 1 star. So just like a terrible helmet. So there's something very drastically wrong with the system when we're all conditioned as humans to be like, the best sneakers are more expensive, the best skates are more expensive, the best helmet, I'm going to protect my kid with the best helmet, and it's one of the worst helmets.
One of the interesting things in the Outside the Lines documentary that came with this piece was that the way that they're designing the helmets and deciding how much they're worth was presenting skull fracture and not presenting concussion. And so it's like calibrated to like a rubric that is not what the rubric that parents are caring about when they're trying to decide what to get for their kids.
Right. Like it protects, what was it, like the G forces to protect from a skull fracture. And meanwhile, it's like that's an anomaly versus the everyday hits that it's doing nothing for that, you know, when you stack them up can be debilitating.
And I think this somewhat depressingly speaks to the nature of concussions and the nature of helmets, because they're helping you with blunt force contact from the outside, but that's not what even causes concussions necessarily. It's your brain decelerating and bruising up against the inside of your skull that actually causes concussions, and there's nothing you can do about that with a helmet, it seems. Like the fact that the number one helmet got 3 stars and was just kind of average isn't super surprising, because concussions, it's hard to imagine a helmet that would stop that deceleration inside your skull.
How can you have a helmet that stops your brain from rattling around in your head?
Right.
That's my number one concern with football. It's like, yeah. Oh, well, they just got to invest on the safety equipment. What safety equipment?
Yeah.
This brings up the question. I think this means that we need to have someone who designs helmets onto the show to talk about. I mean, yeah. There has to be engineering research that's going to this that I'm not read up on. Allison, thanks for bringing this to David Digit this week. We look forward to having many more in the weeks to come. And I know we're not as thrilling as bullfighting in Pamplona, but, you know, we're okay, right? Okay.
Yes, definitely.
We're as dangerous.
We're the matadors of New York City. And so that'll do it for this week's show. Our producer is Jody Avergan. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. You can find us on SoundCloud, on Stitcher, on Downcast, or all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes, so you can subscribe at itunes.com/538. And as we said at the top of the show, please review us, rate us, tell us what you think. It helps others discover the program as well. Thanks to Neil Payne, as always, for coming in.
Thank you, Chad.
Kate Fagan.
Thanks, Chad.
Allison McCann, finally.
Thank you, Chad.
I'm Chad McMatlin. Talk to you next time.